Hello, and welcome to Vanguard Audiobooks and the Learning College. I'm Alex Linder. You can find this and everything we record at vnnforum.com and ultimately at alexlinder.com. Today we're going to do The Feminization of American Culture, a book written by a serious feminist intellectual, amazingly that's not a contradiction, named Anne Douglas back in the mid-late 70s. I think it was 1977, and we're all the way up to Part 3, Chapter 8. And we're going to do about 20 pages. Part 3, Protest, Case Studies in American Romanticism. And we've been talking about the decline into sentimentalism from higher literary and intellectual standards. And we'll continue with that and talk about real romantics, I believe, is where she's headed next. Part 3 of The Feminization of American Culture, Protest, Case Studies in American Romanticism. Margaret Fuller and the Disavowal of Fiction, A Sharp Identity, in quotes. A Sharp Identity. In July 1850, Margaret Fuller was returning to America after participating in the ill-fated Italian struggle for liberty. She never reached land. Her ship foundered on a rock just off Fire Island, and she drowned. Fire Island is today a queer beach resort in New York. So anyway, Margaret Fuller's coming back from Italy. Her ship crashes on a rock and she drowned. Her body was not washed ashore. Ralph Waldo Emerson, Fuller's friend from earlier days, lamented that America had been waiting to welcome her. Elizabeth Barrett Browning, a more recent acquaintance, believed that Fuller, as a woman who had dared to hold profoundly unconventional views, would have met with little sympathy and less understanding in her native land. Browning, a strong admirer of Fuller, Margaret Fuller, concluded the American feminist was, in fact, better off dead. In any case, America was denied or spared a confrontation with one of its genuine heroines, a woman uniquely equipped and determined to challenge the political, artistic, and sexual assumptions of her society. Again, she dies in like 1850. A crucial moment of reckoning was indefinitely postponed. So if she had lived, she might have challenged all this stuff earlier than it turned out. We know who she was, more or less. Emerson's difficult and homely friend, the brightest woman in antebellum New England, the brightest woman in pre-war New England, she edited the transcendental periodical The Dial and invited Boston's Blue Stockings to take part in efforts at self-education called, quote, conversations. Increasingly radical in her maturity, she worked as a journalist in New York, eventually joined the Patriot cause in Italy, had a child by an Italian count much younger than herself, and died at 40. We know her story, but genuine recognition has been slow and intermittent. Margaret Fuller is not an easy woman to face. 50 years after her death, she was profoundly to trouble Henry James, as he tried to write about the period of Italian history she had known firsthand. He claimed that the, quote, Margaret ghost haunted him as no other could. In elucidating her strange power over him, he brings us very close to Fuller and the issues she poses. She suggested for James the boundary between fantasy and reality, literature and history, a distinction fraught for him with sexual connotations. One critic has described James, who's writing in the end of the 1800s, one critic has described Henry James as, quote, the great feminine novelist of a feminine age of letters. Certainly he was preoccupied with the sexual identity of the novel and the novelist. From the start of his literary career in the 1860s, he had insisted to the reading public and himself that fiction, the traditional province of women, be accorded all the seriousness of history, the customary province of men. In 1903, when he made the statement about Fuller, James was ostensibly engaged in writing actual history, a biography of William Wetmore Story. Story, as it sounds, an American sculptor, lived with his wife in Rome in the late 1840s during Fuller's stay there. The city was then in an active state of siege. Rome was crucial in Italy's unsuccessful fight for independence. a fight to which Fuller made an active and impassioned contribution. Significantly, James concentrates on a nostalgic invocation of lost gracious Europe and largely ignores the military and political events taking place. His biography is, in a sense, as much fiction as history. Yet the figure of Margaret Fuller, a close friend of the stories, keeps disrupting the leisurely and protected idyll James creates. She interrupts the story's breakfast hour with news of the war. She diverts them from a stroll to visit a hospital for wounded Italian soldiers. She constantly suggests some crisis the stories and James, with their shared preference for peacetime occupations, are evading. James plays with the possibility of dismissing Fuller as a minor, even a comic figure, but he cannot do it. As he was aware, Fuller herself was engaged at the period he covers in writing a journalistic history of the Roman struggle against their French invaders. Fuller is allowed on stage as James's conscience. She questions his self-announced and reiterated role as, quote, historian. He was disturbed by her because he realized that, legendary as her eloquence had been, she was fundamentally interested, in his words, not in, quote, talk, his own creative obsession, but in facts, end quotes. As Perry Miller has noted, James knew Fuller was a heroine, but it seems unlikely that he ever used her, as Miller has suggested, as a model for any of his female characters. James knew there was a radical disjuncture between Fuller and the heroine of fiction, a creature who mattered as vitally to him as to any woman living by, quote, the immediate aid of the novel, to use his famous phrase, a woman living by the immediate aid of the novel. And he respected that disjuncture. She was too angular to exist comfortably in any world he might create. Indeed, it is greatly to James's credit, and central to his genius, that he could acknowledge Fuller's importance, threatening as it was to him. She might not, one suspects, have been capable of an equal generosity of perception toward him, thinking he's too obsessed with small, irrelevant stuff, and she's dealing with the main issues of the day, the masculine, politics, and war, and that stuff. Facts rather than feelings and talk. James was struck by the major, quote, fact about Margaret Fuller, her achievement of a, quote, sharp identity, an effort, he noted, quote, unaided and ungraced. So she's maybe a salmon swimming upstream, but she is the real thing. And she's basically unheard of today, but I think that part of what you can do when you're writing a PhD thesis and all this stuff is help elevate people you may feel have been unduly marginalized. And again, Anne Douglas, no, that's not a Jew name. This is not a Jew. This is a serious WASP. She probably comes from that region and from that tradition, or at least respects it, as we've said earlier. And so she herself follows in it by being rigorous and serious. And when you're serious, that means you give not only the devil his due, you give everyone his or her due as best you can figure out what that due is. You know, you don't dismiss things simply because you don't like them or because they don't agree with you on everything or they don't see things the way you do. That's puerility. James's instinct that Fuller did not belong to his material is important and provocative. Fuller was and is so disquieting because she does not lend herself to fantasy life, to the essential fictional identity associated with women. Her image can be attacked or ignored, but it is not malleable. Can't be changed. She was what she was. Fuller was finally not even metaphorically a heroine of fiction, though it was a part she coveted and explored. I said in Chapter 2 that the essence of her fictional heroine is her ability to attract flattery without having to solicit it. But Fuller was palpably and embarrassingly unpatronized. Quote, unaided and ungraced, as James recognized, she obviously did her own advance work, and it was hard going. Quote, I now know all the people worth knowing in America, and I find no intellect comparable to my own, she reportedly told a group of friends. She had to flatter herself or teach others how to do it for her, and that made her resentful, and no one could see her true worth. A past mistress of the innuendos of martyrdom, with both an air both exalted and exhausted, she advertised her vulnerability by her intermittent querulousness. She was an asshole in the way women often are. She cut an acquaintance when he talked to her, by his own confession, quote, as I talk to others. She openly demanded everything from anyone who knew her or who would know her. An ultimate effort was the simple price of admission to the sanctum. She expected a, quote, friend to provide her with, quote, the clue to the labyrinth of my being. The very assumption of the difficulty of approach implied in her metaphor might well repel. Unlike Mrs. Hale or Mrs. Sigourney, Fuller did not talk of herself in terms of influence. She saw herself as a complex, rich, and perhaps hopeless problem whose confrontation might precipitate and tax her friends' finest resources. She could not be absorbed. She had to be dealt with. One can hardly imagine Fuller adopting a sprightly nom de plume like Fanny Forrester to advertise her assimilability. In a culture which was beginning to identify femininity with male relaxation, Fuller found few takers. She's no light reading. Fuller was inevitably drawn to the romanticism which found no home in her native land. Here again, names are important. It is striking that Fuller was the only American woman of the 19th century known, like heroines of contemporary romantic European fiction, parentheses Consuelo, Corinne, by her first name alone. In an age when female writers were politely referred to as Mrs. Sigourney, Mrs. Stowe, and Miss Warner, Fuller was called by friends and acquaintances Margaret. By implication, there could be many Fannies or Harriets or Catherines. There was only one, Margaret. She was a romantic. Fuller's great romantic peers and predecessors abroad, Madame de Staël and George Sand, however, had special precedents, sanctions, and abilities denied their American counterpart for making their intricacies in some sense part of their allure. Fuller might emulate and claim their position, she could not approximate the circumstances which made it tenable. It was her often debilitating distinction that she proudly fought the same battle in which de Staël and Sand engaged, without the same armor. De Staël and Sand were beautiful, well-born, wealthy, and they had access to a sympathetic milieu, a salon, and dozens of devoted lovers. Fuller was not good-looking, and it galled her to be, quote, ugly. She did not know a man's love until she was 37, although she often sought it. She did not possess or inherit wealth and social standing, and most of her major career decisions were determined and constrained in part by monetary considerations. She was as brilliant as Sand or de Staël, but America provided none of the traditional means of utilizing and rewarding intellectual women which France offered. Her conversations could not rival de Staël's or Sand's salons. Fuller's parties of the intellect were pioneering efforts, not accepted rituals. Covert revolt, not overt acculturation, provided what vivacity they could boast. So she has to make her own traditions in her own land. If you don't have something and you need it, you got to make it yourself. Whereas in Europe, even for women, they had these traditions of some degree of intellectual women and salons where the great minds and personalities of the day could mingle, eat, and talk. Fuller's special quality was her invincible historicism. She had nothing to give nor to rely on but herself. Her case was significant and fascinating because it rested, perforce, solely on its own merits. So all she has going for her is just that, whatever she has going for her. She doesn't have background, she doesn't have money, she doesn't even have looks. So she has no carte of entree to join the ranks. She feels, and I guess correctly, that her mind is entitled to mix among. As a young woman, she wished desperately to be adored, idealized. From necessity and temperament, in the end, however, she sought achievement more than flattery. She lacked some of the attributes appropriate to the status of literary heroine, and the discovery of this fact gave her intense pain, but she also came to recognize that the status itself was not equal to her needs or her rights. Fuller's life can be viewed as an effort to find what she called her, quote, sovereign self, by disavowing fiction for history. Disavowing fiction for history. So she's leaving the traditional women's genre for the masculine one. The realm of feminine fantasy for the realm of masculine reality, with feminine and masculine in quotes. She recognized, moreover, that such an opposition reflected culturally imposed polarities which she disdained, although she did not always have the energy or the resources to define or redefine her terms adequately. So, you know, if you want something, and even if that's not how people are, seize it, do it, make it happen. Wow others with your, you know, ability or your awesomeness or your energy. And that's why I don't take anyone whining that seriously, and no one really does, because, you know, go do it. No one's really, truly stopping you. Fuller felt, and a writer less than anyone can be stopped, Fuller felt, with justice, that her life was immensely difficult, if not impossible. How, as a woman living in her society, was she to sail safely between Scylla and Charybdis, a rock and a hard place from Greek myth, reject the narcotic of narcissism on the one hand, and escape the penalty of exile on the other? Fuller was often histrionic and over-solemn in her expressed sense of impending personal doom. She took the measure of her world when she assumed that her suffering would equal her aspirations and her achievements. Her air of martyrdom was shrewd analysis, if in somewhat sad and lyrical disguise. One adoring young woman noted that Fuller's face was, quote, full of the marks of pain. Fuller was barely 30 at the time, but whatever her vanity, she proudly exhibited the scars of suffering. Fuller protected and sanctioned herself by commiserating profusely with the cost her life exacted of her, but she never thought she had done, could have done, or should have done otherwise. Self-pity never became sentimentalism. It never seriously sapped her boldness. Fuller did all we can ask of an individual living in a historical context mainly repressive of the best in her. When she could, she walked toward what she sensed as the opening area of significance. When she could not, she dragged herself, crowded herself, edged herself into new territory. If that meant falling over a cliff, she fell. Like Harriet Beecher Stowe, she could not do away with what was weakest, most culturally damaged in herself. Unlike Stowe, she held it as a curious kind of hostage to what she believed strongest, most respect-worthy in herself. The laughter that Fuller's claim for herself inspired in her own day and since is instructive. She nags the American imagination. Immortalized in a curious oblivion, left in the stocks of history, she seems to suggest the perils for women of insisting on attention for their integral selves. You don't get it by insisting, she discovered, but she also raised the question as to whether you get it if you don't insist. She could never fully admit or believe that she expected to survive, but she picked the place where she wanted to go down. She never wavered in her determination to live her own life and not someone else's. In this determination was comprised whatever genuinely clarified meaning she gave to the rejection of fiction or fantasy, for history or reality, she would not be bought off with vicarious experience or power. If she could not always find the first-hand material she sought, she could always reject the second-hand. Her energies were in part consumed in the struggle such an existence entailed, but she had no choice. Margaret Fuller's business was salvaging her opposition intact. She found some aid and much resistance in her effort. The legacy of Timothy Fuller, the will to action. By her early 20s, Margaret Fuller had the reputation of being the best-read person, female or male, in New England. In a sense, this was a reputation which was planned for her before her birth by an eccentric father, as ambitious for his firstborn as he was for himself. So again, here's the effect you can have on your own children. Timothy Fuller was an active, influential politician and lawyer until his well-known opposition to Andrew Jackson cut short his career in 1832. Before and after his fall, he always had time and energy to spare for the personal supervision of Margaret's education. He trained her rigorously and exhaustively in the classics and history. Her young life was devoted, Fuller later recalled, to studying and demonstrating what she had learned from the most exacting of instructors. With me, Fuller concluded dramatically, much of life was devoured in the bud. Well, life is choices, and to choose one thing often means to reject something else that may be just as good. You can study Latin and Greek, or you can run around in the garden. When Fuller wrote this around 1840, she was recording changed concepts of childbearing as well as self-pity, but her assessment of her childhood is not altogether a fair one, nor one to which she herself always subscribed. It is possible that, despite her honesty, she occasionally preferred to stress her father's aspirations for her rather than admit her own ambition. At age 11, away at school, she wrote home to Mr. Fuller, quote, "Be assured that I will do my utmost to equip myself well. I think of nothing else." She was soon in first place in the academic rolls of Dr. Parkes's school, if not in the hearts of her fellow students. The German scholarship and literature she read in her early 20s, in a successful effort to become one of the leading experts on contemporary German culture in America, she mastered on her own. A major quarrel arose between father and daughter in 1832 when Mr. Fuller wished to retire after his political defeat to rural Groton, and Margaret wanted to remain in Cambridge to consolidate and display her scholarly achievements. Groton is one of the big Andover, Exeter, the big prep schools that training the American Northeastern elite. Margaret always regretted the terse enmity in which the two lived in Groton shortly before Mr. Fuller's unexpected death in 1835, but nothing could have better underscored their essential similarity. In any case, whether she was the object or the heir of her father's obsessive intellectual ambition, Margaret Fuller acknowledgedly benefited by his training in major ways. For there is another perspective from which to view Timothy Fuller's schooling of his daughter other than the one which highlights its very real brutality. As a contemporary noted, there was nothing unusual about the work expected from the 6-year-old Margaret by her father, except that it was demanded from a girl. Frederick Hedges, later a friend of Margaret's and early destined by his family for Harvard in the ministry, underwent a similar educational ordeal. The point is less that Margaret's father wished she were a boy than that he treated her with as much seriousness as if she were one. Although Timothy Fuller had married a lovely-looking woman and was to have one beautiful daughter, Margaret's younger sister Ellen, he asked of Margaret not feminine grace and imprecision, but masculine fidelity to fact, to quote, common sense. And she at least is proof that women can be remarkably trained or taught or led or developed into all kinds of different things, including someone very intellectually rigorous. And of course, she has her father's genes too. She has the best of both worlds, the genes and the training, the genes and the culture, the nature and the nurture. In an age when women were taught to appropriate a special language of politeness and complaisance, Mr. Fuller forbade Margaret the use of phrases like "I am mistaken" and "it may be so." Direct quotes. She can't use "I am mistaken" and "it may be so." He forcibly cut her off from the feminine subculture of etiquette books and sentimental novels. Fuller felt her father's training had suppressed her, quote, dreams, her tendency to infatuation, direct quote. But she always remembered he had paid her the final compliment, one which ages of chivalry had seldom accorded women, of criticizing her. The critic is your friend, if serious, because he shows you what's wrong with you, which leads you to have the chance to perceive it yourself and correct the error, if you can, if you want to. It was only when she was terribly and apparently fatally sick in her mid-20s that he expressed his opinion of her, and it was a characteristic blend of exuberance and judiciousness. She had her defects, he believed, but no real faults. As Fuller later acknowledged, he taught her what almost none of her feminine peers possessed: self-respect, self-reliance. He subjected her to none of the bewildering flattery which makes its recipient dependent on its donor for her sense of identity. Because it's all coming from the outside. Others are validating you rather than your understanding of standards and whether or not you're meeting them, which is, once you understand what the standards are, is simply a matter of honesty. being honest with yourself, and for people who might go either way, it begins with others being honest with you. She had, no matter how precariously, what Horace Bushnell found so helpful, a sense of her place. Although Fuller would court and receive flattery, even homage in her later years, she tried to use it to sustain her in her pursuit of the truth, not deter her from it. She continually sought ego confirmation in order that she might learn to do without it. In 1842, she wrote a friend, "I would have my friends tender of me, not because I am frail, but because I am capable of strength. Patient because they see in me a principle that must, at last, harmonize all the exuberance of my character." Mr. Fuller fostered in Margaret his own passion for accuracy, a passion which, in the more unstable, imaginative, and brilliant daughter, deepened into a profoundly ethical concern for veracity, for reality itself. "Give me truth, cheat me by no illusion," direct quote, she once wrote, and the words could have served as the motto of her life. Wish we had a few more journalists who thought like that today, don't you? Timothy Fuller set, quote, masculine ideals of character for his daughter, and he gave her, quote, masculine subjects to study. She puts them in quotes because she doesn't believe that herself, and her own development is in line with it. She believes that those are sex independent. They may vary with sex some, or they may be more common in one sex than the other, but they're not sex inherently sexual characteristics. Just tendencies. They tend to be correlate with one or the other, but they're open to anyone who's honest and rigorous. And she does accept, she herself believes, Douglas does, that these are the correct values, and this is the correct way to look at things. Timothy Fuller set masculine ideals of character for his daughter, and he gave her masculine subjects to study. First at Harvard and later in his legal and political work, he had deeply imbibed the rhetoric and philosophy which the generation who fought the American Revolution had drawn from classical Rome. At a time when the accomplishments of music, art, domestic crafts, and the polite languages and the belles lettres were stressed in feminine education, when it was a moot point whether Latin, much less Greek, should be included in the young lady's curriculum, Mr. Fuller made the classics, especially those of Rome, Margaret's staple fare. She responded with intense and long-lived enthusiasm. In her fragmentary autobiography, she tried to sum up the lesson of Latin antiquity as she had understood it. History was more important than literature. It was, quote, "it was degeneracy for a Roman to use the pen. His life was in the day, the will, the resolve of man. It has been expressed, fully expressed. The books she venerated urged their readers not to read or write, but to live." Mr. Fuller, as Margaret proudly noted in later years, was no mere word hero. He, like the Romans they both admired, was a speaker and man of action, a man conscious of history. Margaret drew close to her father during their unhappy Groton years only when she helped him in his researches in the American past. Thomas Jefferson, who struck her as being as many-sided as Goethe, was a major discovery. His achievement, she wrote a friend, reconciled her to America. All her life, Fuller liked to identify herself with the American eagle, and to do so was not mere self-dramatization. It testified to the fact that she had been trained in the rhetorical and political tradition of the American Revolution. Unlike many of her peers, she felt no need to minimize or exalt the founding fathers. She squarely defined their legacy as the struggle for independence by violence if necessary, and she expanded her finest adult energies in rescuing it from obsolescence. The difficulty for Margaret Fuller from the start was in reconciling her historical consciousness with her feminine identity. It was her pride to claim open access to the whole world of achievement, and she learned enormously from a series of outstanding men, first her father, later Emerson, Goethe, Mickiewicz, and Mazzini. Yet she always felt incumbent on her an act of sexual translation which she found sometimes hard to make. There were masculine words and actions she valued for which she could find no readily available equivalents in the feminine vocabulary. I love best to be a woman, she lamented in her early 30s, but womanhood is at present too straitly bounded to give me scope. Since there was no overt institutional encouragement or acknowledgement of Fuller's intellectual progress, it had to appear both self-motivated and subversive. Harvard, let's see, and again, you know, they always hear, this is the difference between honest feminism and dishonest. She's saying that this woman was essentially made by her father, who had great intellectual ambitions and schooled her and raised her up to be a great intellectual, as well as spermatically giving her the genetic basis for great achievement. Rather than suppressing the woman, the patriarchy is helping this woman, right? So think about that. So Douglas is paying tribute to this. She's not a liar, an idiot. Oh, men are holding women back. Was this guy holding his daughter back when he raised her and taught her extremely rigorously? That's the reality. Wherever there was a woman of exceptional talent, she was almost always helped by the men around her. You know, you think of Emily Dickinson, basically lived with her sister and her sister's husband in a room and wrote her poetry. And, you know, so is this guy suppressing her or charging her? But no, he's letting her live there and do her thing, because that was what she was. She was a poet. She wasn't really meant to have a huge amount of life experiences like an average sort of woman, but to really think about the little things that happened to her and turn it into art. So the men are found helping women, not suppressing them. It's garbage. Harvard, in whose vicinity Fuller lived until her early 30s, of course excluded women. Since she handily out-talked and out-thought Harvard's finest graduates, she suggested the possible superfluity for the genuinely gifted of the male-created and male-servicing system of higher education, which was New England's pride. No one who met her during her lifetime, and she encountered many of the formidable intelligences of her day, failed to leave on record his impression that he had met one who took the measure of his mind, one who was literally peerless. Even as a young woman, Fuller was tutoring and inspiring some of Harvard's finest students. In the early 1830s, James Freeman Clark, a close friend of Fuller's, and destined to become a leading Unitarian minister, wrote her that he expected her to head a great new school of American letters, of which he would gladly be a humble member. In Victorian America, however, to acknowledge Fuller's astonishing intellect was, at least in part, to condemn her. Clark repeatedly told her, to her clear chagrin, that he considered her far too superior to the rest of her sex to be the object of his romantic affections. Later, James Russell Lowell parodied her intellectual superiority and self-involvement. Quote, I myself introduced, I myself, I alone, to my land's better authors solely on my own, he makes his absurdly pretentious Miranda assert in A Fable for Critics. Emerson acknowledged that every time he saw her, she had palpably grown in advance since their last encounter. Every step she took, and she took alone. Every step seemed to prove something about feminine potential and masculine privilege, which most of New England's male elite did not want to know. Viewed from their perspective, her progress was an insult. Hawthorne was not alone in his vicious hope that this woman who had tried to be her, quote, her own redeemer, would prove, quote, a very woman after all, no better than, quote, the weakest of her sisters. It was immensely difficult for Fuller not to internalize this kind of condemnation as a will to failure. Indeed, she quite literally exhausted vital powers in trying to evaluate such rejection and respond to it rightly. So she did face opposition. It might have been jealous or sexual or both a little bit. The difficulty was such that her critics were in at least one sense right. Her accomplishments did define her as an outcast, even as a freak. She had almost no feminine precedents or models to help her believe in what she was and discover what she wanted to become. Among women of her personal acquaintance, Fuller found no one whose life could serve as a blueprint for hers. Her mother, a self-sacrificing gentlewoman who tended her garden and her numerous offspring with affection, if not astuteness, clearly counted for little in Fuller's childhood. As a child, she had ambitious dreams about her mother dying. Only much later did she find in Mrs. Fuller's placidity a resource. In an effort to supplement Mrs. Fuller's maternal image, Fuller was persistently drawn to women older than herself. In girlhood, she attached herself to a charming and cultured visitor from England. Later, she became intimate with a childless, English-born Mrs. John Farrar. The well-bred and intelligent wife of a distinguished Harvard professor, Mrs. Farrar was the author of the best etiquette guide of the day, The Young Lady's Friend. She was a friend indeed to the young, but not always ladylike, Fuller, correcting her manners and offering to take her abroad in 1835. A woman, however, who believed the, quote, great business of feminine life was, quote, shopping, and who cautioned her readers to beware lest their voices, quote, be heard above the gentle hum around you, either in laughter or conversation, had only limited usefulness as a mentor to a girl whose wit was to make Emerson laugh more than he liked, and whose compelling conversation was destined to silence professional talkers. Looking for models outside her own circle of personal acquaintances, Fuller found, especially in America, a relatively barren field. In a period when ambitious American women were increasingly seeking careers in literature, she disavowed fiction. Despite her admiration for the imaginative work of George Sand and Madame de Stael, Fuller only once directly essayed a work of fiction, a short story which has since disappeared. Refusing to write for the increasingly powerful Godies, she condemned the magazine literature typical of contemporary feminine subculture as, quote, flimsy beyond any texture that was ever spun or dreamed of by the mind of man, a mere, quote, opiate. Her sense of mission was too intense and too entirely self-centered to allow her to try fully to understand the causes of these deficiencies. There were real limits to Fuller's sisterliness. She seldom talked long with those who function, whatever their reasons, as opponents to her precariously held sense of superiority. She summed up her utter disavowal of the burgeoning ladies' culture in a word. It lacked, quote, reality. Feminine literature, as it was beginning to flourish in Fuller's day, offered, to her mind, an evasion of American history, not an entrance into it. The only American woman author Fuller ever paid tribute to was the novelist Catherine Maria Sedgwick, and she bestowed on her very tempered praise. Fuller liked the older writer's freedom from sentimentality, her common sense, her interest in history. The, quote, domestic novel, the specialty of the women who succeeded Sedgwick, had little to say to Margaret Fuller. Fuller felt no special hostility toward domestic life and labor, but she had no animus driving her to exalt its claims. She wanted to write critical and political essays, an ambition never widespread among literate American women, and in Fuller's day fast disappearing altogether. Not surprisingly, Fuller was most drawn toward women who had participated actively in the making and the talking of history. She admired the heroines of revolution and rhetoric. Women who, like the Founding Fathers, had acted, spoken, and written for the furtherance of a cause. It tells us a good deal about Fuller's implicit analysis of the role of women in America that the only women she found, at least in part worthy of emulation, were all foreigners. Madame Roland, Madame de Stael, and George Sand, again, George Sand was a woman. Madame Roland wrote her Girondist husband's tracts and lost her life during the French Terror for her commitment to the distinction between republicanism and anarchy. Her memoir, written in prison, was a model of the classic art of apology. Fuller found her an exception to her sex, of, quote, Roman strength and simpleness of mind, not sentimental, able to see beyond mere personal experience. Madame de Stael interpreted and publicized the new Romantic German culture in France, although Napoleon banned her books. When de Stael asked her close friend Talleyrand if Napoleon was as intelligent as she, he responded, "He isn't as brave." And on numerous occasions, Madame de Stael made this compliment appear simple observation. Fuller decided, young, that she wanted to resemble the brilliant de Stael rather than the useful Maria Edgeworth. George Sand left her husband in 1830 to come live in Paris with her first lover, just when, as she put it, the revolution was in permanent session. It was a many-sided and prolonged revolution which Sand, as a woman and an artist, never ceased to support during Fuller's lifetime. Her novels, as she was the first to admit, were novels of ideas, propaganda on a high level. Fuller followed Sand's career with passionate interest. Her friends constantly compared the two women, who were only 6 years apart in age. When Fuller met Sand in Paris in 1847, the older writer looked at her and, with her usual instinct for the right words, said slowly and distinctly, "C'est vous. It is you." Fuller loved her then, but she had long defended the French novelist in a provincial culture which read her to condemn her. Madame Roland was dead before Fuller's birth, however, and neither De Stael nor Sand fully satisfied her needs. She scented in both, and not inaccurately, self-indulgence. They had been, quote, fed on flattery. They were not Romans. Sensibility vitiated their rhetoric. They had allowed themselves to exploit the weaknesses traditionally permissible, even encouraged, in their sex. Of De Stael, Fuller noted in 1844, quote, "While she was instructing you as a mind, she wished to be admired as a woman. Sentimental tears often dimmed the eagle glance." Discovering the same failing in Sand, she queried with anguish, "Will there never be a being to combine a man's mind and a woman's heart, and who yet finds life too rich to weep over? Never?" Fuller was hypercritical on many occasions, but this was not one of them. Her tone was one of anguish, not condemnation. She needed desperately to believe that a total integrity, the only goal she saw as worth attaining, was attainable. And how could she believe it if there was no woman who had ever achieved it? She was never unaware that the narcissism to which the absence of models would temporarily drive her was, finally, more limiting than liberating. So if you have only yourself, like, no one showed me how to do it, I had no way, I had to make it my own way, and inevitably, you become narcissistic, proud, stubborn. You're not going to change. That's the cost of fighting uphill your whole life, as we in the white right would certainly know. Next subsection, the transcendental years, eloquence, quote-unquote, as narcissism. In 1835, at 25, Margaret Fuller was, in many respects, at an impasse. Released from the pressures of Timothy Fuller's dictatorial rule, she assumed many of his responsibilities, but the role of head of the family was, for her, a duty, not a vocation. Marriage seemed unlikely. She disliked teaching. Her ambivalent awareness that she had few models to imitate, her confused predilection for life over literature, her fascination with rhetoric and talk, drew her naturally to the transcendental group in Concord, New Hampshire. She was closely associated with them until 1843. Almost all the members of the group were, like Fuller, rebellious Unitarians, elitists dedicated to preaching and proselytizing, interested in Romanticism and many varieties of liberal, even radical reform, i.e. crazy ideas. Most fundamentally, however, transcendentalism represented an at least theoretical commitment to experience over erudition, and, by this definition, Fuller was a transcendentalist par excellence. Transcendentalism was, for Fuller, as for a few of her fellow transcendentalists, however, a bridge, albeit a shaky one, from literary to historical consciousness. When Fuller heard Emerson proclaim his scorn for over-reliance on reading, when she assisted at Bronson Alcott's Temple School, where conversation, not memorization, was stressed, she observed closely and seriously. Her growing distrust of New England bookishness and its oppressive role in the process of feminine socialization is abundantly manifest in this period. Although she had trained herself to be a scholar of monumental proportions, she was gathering materials for a major study of Goethe, she kept evading actual scholarly achievement. She told Emerson she preferred to do a sketchy and imperfect work on Goethe rather than allow herself to linger too long under his influence. She finally contented herself with a short, brilliant essay on the German writer. She required no reading of the participants in the, quote, conversations she held for interested women every winter from 1839 to 1843. This gave an air of insubstantiality to many of the discussions, which ranged loftily but vaguely over vast topics and ideas. The nature of the Greek religion, the meaning of life, were questions that apparently could be debated on the spot with no external aids or preparation. During one of the 1841 conversations, Fuller told her class, quote, she could keep up no intimacy with books. She loved a book dearly for a while, but she was sure to take a disgust to it to outgrow it. Having gleaned what an author had to give, she, quote, tired of him, even in the case of Shakespeare. There was bravado in this remark, of the kind essential to the liberating therapy the conversations were intended to provide for Fuller and her feminine friends. Fuller's involvement in women's education, as well as her observation of her culture more generally, had convinced her, as we have seen, that while girls were taught even more subjects in school than their brothers, they learned next to nothing because they were not called upon to reproduce, reproduce in quotes, to use what they knew. In her conversations, Fuller was addressing women who had read too much, listened too much, and thought for themselves too little. She could not teach them, as Goethe advised, to study the natural world, for she herself had little bent that way, but she could at least help them to observe the workings of their own minds, to be critics rather than consumers. And her partly assumed iconoclasm was a way of throwing them back on themselves, of making them take themselves seriously, if only because she allowed them to tap no other resource. Sarah Clark, one of Fuller's friends, explained perceptively the cause of the legendary and fanatic love which younger women yielded Fuller. Quote, you felt exhilarated by the compliment of being found out, and even that she had cared to find you out. Fuller acted as if what her pupils felt and said was not merely decorative, but consequential. The revolt against books, against the role of reader, which she enacted for her feminine pupils and herself, was a symbolic protest against the derivative lives to which their society consigned them. They, Fuller insisted, were originals. Yet if Fuller was clear during her transcendental period about what she was rejecting, she was much less sure about what she was putting in its place. No one can read the accounts of the conversations, not to speak of the correspondence with Emerson, and escape the realization that Fuller did not yet know her true direction. She was in a state of acute opposition, and her answer, not finally a successful one, was to offer herself repeatedly, insistently, even belligerently, as the living example, as if attention to her presence would generate or dictate the content of what she was to represent. Fuller's pretensions at this time were enormous. Her friends, following her example, called her a sibyl, a seer, and she was, for she was desperately engaged in trying to prophesy herself. Emerson, James Freeman Clark, and William Henry Channing, 1810 to 1884, all found Fuller similar to De Stael's romantic heroine Corinne in her abilities as an improvisatrice, the female who improvises. Julia Ward Howe called her, that's the one who wrote the Battle Hymn of the Republic, remember? Julia Ward Howe called her grandiloquent, direct quote. Yet Fuller was not acting in any artificial sense. She fell into a form of behavioral rhetoric, partly as a natural translation of the classical prose she had memorized in girlhood, the Roman stuff, partly and more importantly as a complex means of self-anticipation. Fuller had no real models, as we have seen, close at hand, so as she apparently imitated Corinne or De Stael, she was actually using grandiose gesture as a way of objectifying herself in order then to have a model. At this point in her career, she was trying, in a rather special sense, to be a literary heroine. Fuller's rather heavy insistence on suffering and her mystic powers in the late 1830s and early 1840s was part of her claim to this role. It was narcissism, but a narcissism born of utter necessity, and one that was somewhere intended to self-destruct, if only through its own excesses. Emerson saw astutely that Margaret wanted to be a, quote, living statue, and one always placed to best advantage. He failed altogether to see that she had to be her own precedent, that she had first to embody what she somewhere wished to transcend. He had little compassion for the terrors inherent in such a procedure. Her, quote, mountainous me, to use Emerson's description of her self-importance, her monotony of self-magnification, were necessary defenses. She had to claim tragic stature. Witty on occasion herself, she always found it painful to be the object of wit. Staying at the Emersons in 1840, she was troubled by her charming but ne'er-do-well brother-in-law, the poet Ellery Channing, also a visitor, who liked to amuse himself at her expense. Teasing her for her seriousness, he criticized, "You are too ideal. You make everybody restless by always wanting to grow forward. Now I like to grow backward, too." Emerson was intrigued with such lightheartedness, which made Fuller's earnestness appear lumbering. Fuller resolved somberly and ponderously in her journal, "I must not let him, Ellery Channing, disturb me. This child of genius must not make me lay aside the armor without which I am long since lain bleeding on the battlefield. I am what I am." She could tire of her earnestness, but she was too beleaguered. She could not afford to laugh at herself, because she had to take herself seriously. She had to seriously create the model in using the good she had herself in her own mind and her own thoughts, because there was no external one to copy. And that, if that made her overly heavy and statuesque and mountainous and overly serious, that's the cost of it. Things don't come for free. De Stael's heroine, Corinne, to whom Fuller was so often compared, was an artist gifted in many directions, but chiefly she was a brilliant, spontaneous talker, an improvisatrice. I guess that means someone witty as well, someone who improvises verbally, I suppose. She displayed eloquence, and she's the one who, as I've said many times, was famously described the condom as a cobweb against danger and a breastplate against pleasure. So that to me is all the proof you need, a proof in one line that this woman was a great wit. There was no other aspect of the narcissistic role of romantic heroine which Fuller found so congenial. Eloquence certainly offered partial solutions to Margaret Fuller's most basic problems as an American, a woman, and an artist. Yet it was an answer she inevitably strained to the breaking point. It is important to remember that the eloquence so prized by Emerson, Fuller, and their friends meant to them public speaking, a high form of that rhetoric on which Fuller had been raised. Emerson found eloquence, although rarely, in the impassioned speeches of Daniel Webster. Eloquence was in essence oratory, a meeting place between literature and life, and a genuine flourishing American form which Timothy Fuller, lawyer and politician, had doubtless taught and exemplified to his daughter. So this is the culture they come from, where speaking in public is the high art form. Whether you're a lawyer, a politician, or even a writer, you write books, but then you go out and you lecture to the public. You go around giving speaking tours, and you show your eloquence, and that's the finest flower. The American Revolution, which they had studied together, had begun with just such rhetoric. School children then as now believed that the statement, "Give me liberty or give me death," was equivalent to the onset of hostilities. Think about that in relation to the alt-right today and the situation whites find themselves. In a country as new and as absorbed in material progress as America, spontaneous eloquence, which took less time and training than the production of an epic or a novel, was bound to win highest honors. To be a talker, to be, quote, eloquent, was to be American. Both Margaret Fuller's detractors and her admirers in her own day, and since, knew that she could talk incomparably better than she could write, although few of them understood why. Emerson, contemplating a biography of Margaret Fuller, recorded his fear that he and her other male friends lacked the courage to confront her life, a life whose activity, audacity, and integrity made theirs seem cowardly and trifling.
Nevertheless, he let himself dismiss her finally in his journal as representing, quote, an interesting hour in New England culture. Already the author of dozens of immortal essays and poems himself, Emerson judged that Fuller's influence would not outlive her. She had talked while he had written. Fuller's failure as a writer was not as entire as Emerson liked to believe, but it is true that her early poetry was, as she said, all rhetorical and impassioned, and the didactic critical prose she produced, that is excessively teachery, in her transcendental years, awkward and incomplete. Yet during these years, she was consolidating her reputation as one of the greatest talkers in America, and her masterful late prose would demonstrate that her problem was not a simple lack of talent for writing. There are many possible reasons for Fuller's over-reliance on the spoken medium during much of her adult life in America, not least of which was the fact that she was a woman. In a society that offered little encouragement for intellectual women, Fuller needed the stimulus of a present audience to dare to display her full powers. She had been denied the self-confidence needed for long-term productivity, for working without the reassurance of immediate attention and approval. William Story called Fuller her own worst enemy, but he forgot that this role can be itself a punishment imposed by a society on its deviants and rebels. Could she have been able to imagine, as she took up her pen, an American audience willing to accept philosophical, political, and ethical instruction from a feminine mind? The presence and popularity of Godey's and its ilk were hardly encouraging. When I meet people, she explained, it is easy to adapt myself to them, but when I write, it is into another world. She could only believe such an audience existed when she saw it in front of her. Utterly dependent on the live inspiration, which provided an unacknowledged cover for sexual rebellion, Fuller penalized herself for her superior intelligence by sabotaging its reliability and narrowing its range of impact. Not surprisingly, Fuller did her finest writing before 1843 in the informal, personal mode of the letter. There she could best sustain the illusion of an actual audience. She wished, as she wrote Emerson, to be and portray, quote, a soul ever rushing forth in the tides of genial life. She wanted to embody herself in her words. As a result, all writing, to a certain extent, failed her. Only as a talker did she feel entire confidence and conviction. Yet even Fuller's legendary eloquence was poured forth during her transcendental period as much to testify by its force that she was right as to reveal what she was right about. She lamented to her closest friends that she had found no one sufficiently capacious and challenging to draw out her full conversational powers. This was no boast, but a plea, and one with real pathos. She had nobody to truly talk to. She felt tormented that she could procure so little help in knowing herself. She still half believed that if she could talk well and long enough, she would find herself in the dazzling flow of words. But she only half believed it. Her conversations suggested that the experience which was to replace erudition was to be eloquence itself. Eloquence itself a form of parasitism, and Fuller felt the paradox. Through her eloquence, she could only attempt to stress and embody the primacy of experience she was aware she had not known. In one of her conversations, Fuller remarked that eloquence was a kind of thieving. She had long realized that her greatest temptation was to, quote, profane life with rhetoric. She asked too much of herself not to feel that eloquence was for her a form of pretense, at its best a pledge, at its worst a lie. You're talking about stuff you haven't done. It's the heart of it, and that's no doubt why she eventually went to Italy, to be in the life. To be eloquent was apparently to be outside and above the feminine subculture as it existed in the Northeast, but was not eloquence nonetheless a higher form of influence? Merely a higher form of influence. Self-advertisement, no matter how magnificent or strident, was not self-actualization. And ultimately Fuller would be satisfied with nothing else. Her lament that she had found no one to bring her out as a talker only highlights the vicious circle she was in during her late Concord years. Since she had no refuge at this time but the myth of her eloquent, grandiose self, she was drawn to those who also needed to believe in it. She was attracted precisely to those who might eventually damn or abandon her, but who would never creatively share the doubts about herself which constituted her most important hope of fulfillment. She was drawn, in other words, to Ralph Waldo Emerson. And that's where we'll close for today, and we'll pick it up next time there in the story of her involvement with Emerson and then the rest of her life and career. Anyway, very interesting stuff about a lesser-known character in American literature, Margaret Fuller. Thanks for being with me today, and I'll be back with you again real soon.